Welcome to SportsWise, a podcast about sports and the law with your host, me, Gabe Feldman, director of the Tulane Sports Law Program and co-director of the Tulane Center for Sport. On this episode, I'm joined by Mike McCann, legal analyst at Sportico and director of the Sports and Entertainment Law Institute at the University of New Hampshire School of Law, and Jeremy Duru, director of the Sport and Society Initiative at American University Washington College of Law. For the first ever draft of the most significant issues in the sports law world. That's right, we're drafting sports law stories and breaking them down. And you're going to love it. Here we go. Welcome back to the podcast, Jeremy Duru and Mike McCann. Thanks for coming back on, guys. We are going to, for the first time in recorded history, I think some of these have been done unrecorded, but this is the first recorded history, do a draft of the biggest sports law issues going on right now in the country or the world, but primarily probably the country. And we're going to do a snake draft. Everybody's going to get to pick three issues. And you have to explain why your issue is significant. And that could be significant any way you put it, whether it's in terms of impact it's going to have, interest it's generating, whatever it may be, however you want to define it. Okay. And I've done a random draft order. I did freeze one of the ping pong balls to fix it a little bit, but we've got Mike going first. Jeremy going second. I will go third. It's a snake draft. I will then get to pick again, and then we'll go back to Jeremy and then Mike, and then we'll go all the way through till we have three picks. Okay? All right. Sound good?
Sounds good.
Yes, sir.
All right. Here we go with the first pick of the inaugural sports law issue draft. Mike selects.
When college athletes are going to be recognized as employees. And I don't know if that may be a big topic that we want to break up into different pieces for purposes of the draft. I don't want to take.
Yeah, you might have just drafted like the Alabama offensive line. I think you have to pick one player, okay. One All right. specific so, issue.
Yeah, I'm going to take from that I'm going to pick Dartmouth. Dartmouth college, men's college basketball team pursuing recognition as a union. And the reason why I'm picking that first is I think it will move faster than some of the other matters. And because of that, I think it will end up being more impactful, that it will lead to a resolution or some sort of resolution on whether college athletes are employees and can form a union. So my sense is that one's going to move a little bit faster than some of the other pieces of college athletes as employees.
All right. That's a good pick. It's a solid four-year starter. You know what you're getting. Here's my question to both of you. Let's say that the board does recognize Dartmouth men's basketball players as employees and it goes through the appeals process and they are able to hold an election. Do you think, and I would think it probably wouldn't, maybe it would get held this year. Do you think that they would vote in favor of unionization?
Those players?
Yeah.
Yes, 100% sure.
Jeremy?
Yeah, I tend to agree as well. Yeah.
Okay. And 100% sure, Mike, because they're the ones who are pushing this effort?
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you think that Harvard men's basketball players would follow suit? I don't mean Harvard in particular, but do you think this would be the start of a trend where there's this untapped interest in college athletes or college basketball players at Ivy League schools to unionize?
Yeah,
I think the Princeton basketball players are already talking about it. So I think the answer is yes.
And
would be on basketball too.
Yeah.
I think we'll see other athletes do it.
And so let me just stick with Dartmouth for a second. What do you think they negotiate for? What do you think is the outcome of the first collective bargaining agreement? And let's just assume for sake of argument that it's Dartmouth basketball negotiating with Dartmouth University, right? I know there's lots of issues that might come up with the bargaining unit.
Yeah. I will say terms similar to what their classmates in the dining hall negotiated, which I think is $21 an hour. And I think here the players also want money for out-of-pocket healthcare expenses. I don't think we're going to see some enormous figure, but I think it would be basically pay us like our classmates who are also working on campus. I think that's what they would seek and I imagine likely get, because the asking price wouldn't be too high, but who knows?
And by the way, I need to correct the record. I meant Dartmouth College. My wife is an alum of Dartmouth. I think I called it Dartmouth University. Yeah. Then maybe I shouldn't have said anything. Okay. What does the NCAA do then if the Dartmouth players negotiate for a salary that is in violation of the current rules? Do they relax the rules? What do they?
Otherwise, they kick out Dartmouth and then they kick out Princeton and then they kick out all these member schools. I don't see how they don't relax their rules. Otherwise, also that could build the argument that they're the joint employer, which we could touch on in some of the other potential draft picks. But I don't know. Okay, what do you think? Do you think the NCAA just excludes?
I just wonder if Dartmouth says to the athletes, look, we can't pay you a salary because then you wouldn't be eligible. And so we'll negotiate over what we can negotiate, but that's non-negotiable. And then the players go on strike, and then we could see what happens. But I think it's possible Dartmouth says, look, we're going to fight the NCAA too with you, and we think this is something that should be done. But I'm not sure. And I think if it does come to that and they do unionize, then I think the NCAA is going to just have to generally make some significant changes. I don't think that it would be a world where it's just Dartmouth off to the side negotiating a CBA. Yeah. Jeremy, what do you think?
I agree with you both. I think this may get into some future draft picks. I'm not sure what the rules are about talking about future draft picks.
We can go. Yeah, go ahead. You can tie it in now to you. You have the number two pick.
All right. With the second pick of the inaugural sports law issue draft, I'm going to take NIL and particularly House versus the NCAA. And so the segue is, you spoke of the NCAA's relaxation of rules, perhaps in response to what Dartmouth does, and then perhaps Princeton, and as Mike was saying, this can continue. And we saw that sort of relaxation with respect to the NIL rules, because they really were pushing the corner and had no other choice. They didn't want to do it. They had for years said that it would destroy the NCAA to do it, and they had to do it in July 2021. So let's go to the second pick. Recently, there are several players, former student athletes, a case called House versus the NCAA, suing an antitrust against the NCAA with respect to NIL. Their argument is that money they should have been able to get through NIL before the July 2021 suspension of the rules, which I just mentioned, is money that they should get, together with video game money and broadcast right money. And what happened recently is that class certification was granted, which I've come out of the plaintiff's lawyer camp. I was a plaintiff's lawyer before I became a law professor. And any plaintiff's lawyer knows, particularly class lawyers know, that the two big things are class certification and then getting past a 12B6 motion to dismiss. And each of those is a huge hurdle. And class certification, I think, is not something that folks in general think a lot about. And that's why I don't think the class cert decision was on the front pages of all the papers. But it's huge, because what it does is it says that these individual student athletes, three of them, get to represent thousands of student athletes. And what that does, among other things, is exponentially increase any damages. And so if they're successful, the amount of money that they would get would be earth-shattering is perhaps too big, but maybe ground-shaking, slightly less than earth-shattering, but it'd be a big deal. So that's why I take it number two.
Yeah, I think it's hard to argue with that. Mike, you just wrote a long piece about this. So do you want to jump in with your thoughts on it?
I think Jeremy summarized it perfectly. This is devastating for the NCAA. And how do they settle this? It's the other thing. I don't know what is the number to settle this if you've got 14,500 athletes covered in the three damages classes? What do they get paid in a settlement? I mean, this is devastating. for the NCAA. And look, there'll be, I mean, if there's no settlement and it goes to trial, there'll be an appeal. It's not, it may not end soon, but it's looking really bad for the NCAA and the Power Five for all the reasons Jeremy noted. And what is the way out? And I don't know what the way out is for the NCAA, other than a settlement that would seem like would require a really huge dollar number.
Yeah, I agree. And I think it's also from, we all know Winston and Strawn, and we know the, at least some of the lawyers in this case, that it's, it seemed like they're doing this as much for, I wouldn't say the principal, but to change the rules, not just to get money down. I'm sure they'd be happy to get a cut of the money damages as well, especially trebled, but that may make it less likely that they settle, but who knows? I do think from Jeff Kessler's perspective, when the Alston case was being litigated and it went to the Supreme Court, most people called it the Kessler case. And I thought, I've never heard of any case called, referred to by the lawyer's name as opposed to the party's name. And that was a big thing for Kessler. I think he may regret it now, though, that the House case is not known as the Kessler case, because it could turn out to be that the House case has the bigger impact than the Alston case. Just,
yeah.
But then again, without the Alston case, we don't have the House case, and we probably don't have half the things we're talking about. Yeah. Which, again, if the NCAA had just left it alone at the Ninth Circuit, then we wouldn't have the Alston case at all in the Supreme Court. Lots
of it would not have been remembered, I think, right? For all sorts of reasons, it was not at the top of anyone's mind.
Right. Okay, my first pick, so the third pick in the inaugural sports law issues draft is, and I may regret this, and this may be recency bias, but the Michigan football sign stealing case. It probably will not have anywhere near the impact that the issues you guys have talked about. But in terms of intrigue and scandal and ridiculousness and characters involved, the fact that you have Michigan football, you have Jim Harbaugh, you have the new Big Ten commissioner, you have the new Big Ten, you have the NCAA and all of its issues with enforcement. You have a guy named Connor Stallions. I don't know. This is like a bad hypo that we might have written for one of our sports law exams, because we've run out of time to think about a good name, so we just made up some name. But the latest development, depending on when you're listening to this, there will surely be a new development by the time this gets published. But Michigan has apparently responded to the notice of discipline from the Big Ten. I don't think the response is public yet, but I think there's been some reporting on it. And they have very clearly argued that if the Big Ten does discipline them, that they will seek an injunction or a temporary restraining order and claim that this goes beyond the scope of the Big Ten's authority, that this is arbitrary and capricious, that this is unprecedented, that they need to wait for the NCAA, there's not enough evidence, all of these arguments. And so I think it's interesting from a legal perspective, because we might have a battle similar to battles we've had with NFL discipline cases about what is the scope, not of the commissioner of the league's authority, but the commissioner of the conference's authority, and what evidence is required. And I also think what's great about this for me as a beleaguered Jets fan is it allows me to talk once again about the common thread in these cases as I see them. Yeah. And that's Tom Brady. Yeah. And so the question is, and I don't think anybody's answered this yet.
You do know we've got Mike McCann on.
That's why I'm trying to poke the bear. Was it more probable than not that Tom Brady was generally aware that Connor Stallions was buying tickets for other people to attend games?
He would give sworn testimony saying no.
Let's get a look at his cell phone and see what he said. For those of you who don't know, Mike not only covered in and out the every second of the Deflategate, but also taught, I don't know, are you still teaching? Taught an entire course on Deflategate.
It's too antiquated now. The students are, it's like something from the past, right?
Yeah.
They didn't experience it. No more Deflategate course. It had its run.
Maybe Stalliongate can be your next course. Yeah. Just throwing it out there. So that's my pick number three. Again, this may turn out to be Much Ado About Nothing. But I do think not the legal issues, but also just the bigger issues. And this came up in Bountygate with the Saints way, way back in the day. So if Deflategate is old news, Bountygate is ancient news. But the idea that Michigan is doing something that maybe lots of other teams are doing in different ways, and why is Michigan being singled out for this? And then the power struggle between a school, the conference, and the NCAA. And if the Big Ten does act and the NCAA doesn't, what does that mean about the future of the NCAA? We're already talking about them maybe being pushed aside, but if they're not even going to be stepping into discipline, I mean, it's up to the conference to do it. I think there's just so many things in here that are interesting. And the fact that Michigan is a national championship contender. So you put all that together, it's my number three. It's my number one pick.
It's like a pick where somebody has a great combine and they pick the player. It's got some risk, that pick, because as you said, his legs may not be an issue in a month, but it could be huge. So it's a gamble, but it's an impressive gamble.
Yeah, I scout a lot. I've been watching tapes of Darko Milicic jumping over chairs. So I feel good about this.
And I think it's a good pick. I think, you mentioned the breadth of decision maker authority. And that's the piece that I think could really be interesting, maybe for sports law nerds like us more than general public. But when you look at the Big Ten sportsmanship policy, it looks like the best interest policy. It looks like conduct detrimental. I mean, it looks like the same sort of thing. And we've had so many cases exploring the breadth of those over the years. It would be fascinating if this became the case that explored the breadth of it for conference commissioners.
And have we, I keep saying this is unprecedented. Are we aware of a case where a conference did discipline a coach under a similar policy? I haven't seen one.
I'm not recalling one.
I'm not aware of one. I mean, maybe.
Yeah. So that,
not certainly recently.
Right. So that's another reason why I think this is interesting, is particularly as it may, and this, I may be stepping on a future draft pick, but what it may mean for conference consolidation and the Big Ten and the SEC eventually running things, or at least running football. That here's a model. And Mike, you've talked about this, that it could turn out to be the AFC and the NFC, or the AL and the NL, and here's the league commissioner making these decisions. Okay, so that's my first pick. My second pick on the way back down is sticking with college sports. So the top four picks will have been college sports related. The NLRB in the USC Pac-12 NCAA case. And this is a little bit, I feel like this is great value because Mike took the NLRB with the first pick, and here I am getting the NLRB in the fourth pick in the second round. But the reason why, I'm not going to say that this is more or less important than the Dartmouth case. Mike, I agree with you, the timing issue, that we could get a decision from the regional director in the Dartmouth case any day now or next week. And so that, for that reason alone, it may be the most significant. But from the broader perspective in the USC case, the fact that this is an opportunity for the NLRB to push the joint employer theory. And they've already come out with a much broader definition than had been established in previous administration. So Jennifer Bruzzo has made pretty clear that she believes not only are college athletes employees, but they're employed by the school and then as joint employers by the conference and the NCAA, which means that the NLRA would apply to all athletes, whether they're at public schools or private schools, because they would be jointly employed by the private conference or the private NCAA. And unlike the Dartmouth basketball players, which are, they work very hard, but they're not quite the poster students of exploitation like FBS football players are. They're not the ones who are dealing with realignment. They're not the ones who are generating billions of dollars. That may not be relevant ultimately, but certainly just atmospherically. And what I think is interesting about the NLRB's complaint is that it's really focused on their handbook rules and social media policy and that element of control. And part of the USC's defense was that they're not rules, they're just recommendations, that the athletes are free to do what they want. So in other words, they're not exercising this complete control over them. And yet, as they're pressing this argument, maybe even the same week that they filed their brief making that argument, USC football lost to Utah and Lincoln Riley didn't make the players available to speak to reporters. He said, only I am going to speak to reporters. You can't speak to my athletes. In other words, I'm going to control my athletes and not let them have access. To the media, which seemed to just be fuel for the NLRB's fire that, yes, these are rules and the coach controls you. And then separately, the conference and the NCAA. So I think, and we were in the middle of a pretrial hearing right now. And then let's see, the rest of the hearing in terms of the substance will be in December, January, and then February. So that's still relatively fast. And that we could get a decision on that relatively quickly, but ties into everything Mike said about the possibility that college athletes, college football players, basketball players will be able to unionize, which then could turn the college sports world on its head. So that's my second pick.
I mean, who did Dartmouth open up against their season against, Gabe, for basketball?
Dartmouth basketball?
Yeah.
Yeah, they opened up against, it was a small private school in North Carolina.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And that is
somebody, they're generating some money. They're playing.
Yeah. That's right? No, and that's a great point. And not to suggest that Dartmouth basketball or Ivy League basketball or any college basketball team doesn't generate some interest and some revenue. And it doesn't matter if they make a lot of money or little money. If they treat them like employees, they're employees, whether it's a successful employer or an unsuccessful employer. I just mean perception wise.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It was interesting in the Dartmouth hearing where the player's lawyer said, there's no test that you have to be part of a profitable enterprise. It's right. A good point. It's something that gets mentioned a lot, that they're not a moneymaker, which they argue is untrue if you consider fundraising. But no, that's it. That could have been the first pick. So look at it. You're getting at four what could have been one. So that's impressive.
I'm excited. Yeah, I also think – oh, go ahead, Jeremy.
I'm just going to say Gabe drafts for value.
I took a reach. With my first pick.
Yeah, Jeremy and I are looking. We may get fired after this. Who knows?
Yeah, I'm worried about it. And now there's a pressure on my on pick number five, which is coming up. So I'm sweating over it.
You're up.
Yeah. Wait, before you make your second, I just want one note on the unprofitability thing. It also cuts the other way that when USC athletes say we're generating billions of dollars, they say, well, that's not relevant.
Yeah.
Either that it's not about how much money you make. These are the other, but I do think the profitability or the income, just if you're thinking about who benefits, who's deriving the benefit, if the school is generating lots of money, you can say, look, they're controlling the athlete and they're there for the benefit of the school more than they are for the benefit of the athlete. That's where I think the revenue generation may have some legal relevance as opposed to just background relevance. But I agree from the strict employment law test, the fact that Dartmouth basketball is maybe not making a lot of money probably doesn't matter. All right, Jeremy, your second pick. A lot of pressure.
All right. So as I look at my draft board, I'm feeling like we're now moving to a second tier. So I feel like we may be out of the first tier. I don't know. With the fifth pick overall, my second pick, I'm going to go with the Pac-12. And particularly with respect to the OSU-WSU move with respect to how this conference is going to be governed. We all were, and I don't think, maybe you two talked when this happened. I didn't speak with either of you, but sports lawyers were having a lot of conversations when over the course of 3 days, the Pac-12 crumbled extraordinarily. And so we know what happened. We know that what was a Pac-12 is now a Pac-2 or a two-pack, as some people call it. And the consequence is, among other things, that you've got these entities still part of this organization that has to do business, but 10 of the entities cannot, the two entities remaining, OSU and WSU, argue, reasonably in my view, that those 10 entities may not have the conference's best interest at heart in that they are leaving. And so OSU and WSU have moved for preliminary injunction, initially an emergency TRO, to stop board meetings so that the 10 of them can't, as a majority matter, make all sorts of decisions for this conference that they're no longer part of. And recently, those leaving responded to the motion, opposed it, obviously, and are arguing that if they're not involved, that OSU and WSU can do whatever they want with the revenue distributions for this year, which would be a massive problem for them and in their view, unlawful. So they oppose the motion. And the reason I think this is important, aside from the fact that the crumbling of a conference in this way is something none of us have ever seen, is that we're going to have, as you referenced, I think earlier, Gabe, realignment is not done. It's going to continue. Who knows what's going to happen with this? So we're going to see more litigation, I think, like this. And so this might give us a window into what we're going to be seeing coming forward.
Yep. It's a good pick. So that means the Pac-12 was picked back to back.
Yeah.
Because Pac-12. They're in the NLRB case as well as this. So probably not where the Pac-12 wanted to be mentioned back to back is in the sports law issues. I do want to say the conference dissolution we have seen was the old Big East back in 2013. And I will always remember this because this is when we had a different round of conference realignment and Marquette joined and I forget what other schools joined. And then it was announced that Tulane was going to join. Mm. And that's when the Big East said, we're out. That we can take these other schools, but if Tulane is in our conference, we're done. And so, and Tulane is in a very different position athletically now than they were then. We're Cotton Bowl champions. We're number 23 in the country in football. We have great men's and women's basketball. So yeah, take that, Big East. You'd be happy to have Tulane right now in your conference. But Jeremy, I agree with you. I think the conference dissolution, the legal issues, the realignment, what it means for the future of college football, college sports, that may end up being the steal of the draft.
All right, I'll take it. I'll take that. I'll take the steal with number
four. Or it might end up being a bust that it gets lost in the history books in 2 years.
I'm a risk taker. I'm willing to. That's why nobody's hired me to be their GM. I take too many risks, but I'm sticking with it.
All right, back to Mike for his last two picks.
Yeah, I thought about picking this number one. So I feel fortunate that it wasn't mentioned, although all of the picks before are all good ones. Johnson versus NCAA. So let's go back east. Let's get away from the West Coast. Let's go to a case that argues that college athletes are employees under the Fair Labor Standards Act, which is a lower threshold than the NLRA. And the core argument is that college athletes are employees for reasons that we've already talked about, so I won't repeat them. But it's interesting because it's a case that says they should at least get paid like their classmates who are doing work study. So minimum wage. And we have seen amicus briefs file. I mean, we've seen all sorts of arguments that this is somehow going to be a devastating blow to college sports. Never mind what the other matters could be to them, but that this one has traction. And we know, and to me, it crystallized in February. There was a hearing before the Third Circuit where you had three judges. One was appointed by President Clinton, one by President Obama, one by President Trump. Very different ideologically all over the board. They were savaging the NCAA's lawyer, saying what you're saying doesn't make sense, saying don't keep bringing up Title IX. You know, you have to comply with all laws. Just because it's more difficult to comply with Title IX if you have to pay athletes, that's not a legal justification, which Judge Wilkin has also mentioned in the House case. I really thought it was, at least to me, it had to be difficult for the NCAA to accept that arguments that they've had traction with in the past just fell on deaf ears with judges that are not agreeing on all sorts of things. And it will take a while for this case. It will go back to the district court in Pennsylvania, and then it will go back to the Third Circuit, and then it will, you know, maybe go to the Supreme Court. We're talking years. But so that's why I think it gets discounted a bit, because its horizon's a lot longer than some of the other things we've been talking about. But to me, this is a case, it reminds me a little of Ed O'Bannon's case, because with Ed O'Bannon's case, I could describe it to people that aren't lawyers and they would get it. Why are they not being paid to be in video games? It doesn't sound right. And similarly here, why are they not being paid like their classmates who are doing work study, some of whom are on full scholarships? Mm-hmm. I don't know. This case has an intuitive appeal to me that whether it ultimately proves successful, I don't know. Whether it gets co-opted by larger cases or NLRB stuff, we'll see. But I like the optics of this case because of how it can be explained.
That's a great pick, Mike. I actually thought about going with it at five. The thing, and I like the way, I like what you said, because the optics, they can easily be explained. And it's actually a very interesting case to teach. I find it interesting because I talk to students and I talk through the Burger case, and I talk about the Burger case is, of course, this is the predecessor of the Johnson case, brought by the same lawyer. And yeah, Paul, and in the Burger case, the court, I think it was the concurrence, said, here's what we're doing. I went in here. But if this were a revenue-producing sport and people were on scholarship, who knows? And the lawyer took that and went out, and now we have Johnson. And so it's an interesting case to show what lawyer and committed to an idea, how it can evolve. So,
yeah,
I agree. And I think, Mike, I had it. That's the end of my top tier. That was the they were all, I could have taken any of them in the top two or three or four. I do think, as you noted, that's an early stage at the motion to dismiss stage. So it's going to have a longer timeline. But if the NLRB cases go against the NCAA, if the Third Circuit goes against the NCAA, which I think they're probably favored to go against the NCAA, I'd say the NCAA is probably the underdog in these cases at this point to some extent. I just wonder, do any of these pieces, because even if I don't know that the status quo is going to be anything, I don't know that the state of the NCAA is going to look in 3 years like it does today. So the fact that the Johnson case may take 3 years to be litigated, it may be moot by then, yep. Right? That they just may already be treated as employees, which doesn't mean the Johnson case isn't important. It just means the Johnson case is part of what's pushing it to change. And you might not need a final decision, whether it's by the Supreme Court or the Third Circuit, whoever it may be. But yeah, great pick. And that's makes six college sports for the first six picks. Will you continue the trend with your
I'm going to pick, and is this a pick, the NCAA going to Congress? Can that be picked, or is that eligible for selection?
I'm going to say no, because I was going to mention it just because I think it just ties in all of these cases.
Okay.
But let's talk about it, because it certainly may, again, make all this other stuff irrelevant if Congress steps in and acts.
Yeah, it generates a lot of news. It certainly is like a recycled news item, right? Every 3 months, we see the same story. NCAA is meeting with members of Congress, and they're optimistic that there'll be a bill. I feel like this is like Groundhog Day, right? Like it just gets replayed and nothing happens. And I mean, it's good for media companies maybe because they can generate content, but I feel like this is going nowhere, particularly with the presidential election coming up. I really am skeptical. And I would just say with the election, this also isn't a pick, but if President Trump is elected next year, how does that affect the NLRB with these college athlete matter? I don't know, but I think that could be an interesting discussion point if that were to occur. So I'll pick something else for number seven. I'm going to go pro sports, and it's going to be the Knicks case against the Raptors over alleged stolen trade secrets, where an executive of the team was leaving the Knicks and allegedly took information with him. To me, this case is interesting. I mean, trade secret stuff is always interesting. It always generates good classroom discussion. And there's a good amount of litigation. So for our students, it's a good entry point. The other piece of it that's interesting, as you both know, is that teams don't sue each other. That this is something that the league constitution goes out of its way to try to preempt, that the Raptors are now saying, look at the NBA's constitution. This is a matter for Commissioner Silver. This is not a matter for a judge. If the case has traction, it would be an interesting, I don't think it will, but if it does have traction, to me, that would be, is this a new ground for litigation, teams suing each other? I don't know. I find it, maybe it's not the most important thing, but I think in the second tier of stuff, it jumps out at me as interesting.
Yeah, I agree. I was actually hoping to get it so I could pair it with my Michigan sign stealing and really have just cornered the market on the trade secret sign stealing. So yeah, I agree. I think it's fascinating. You're right. The team versus team aspect of it and the trade secret aspect of it. And it may not have the legs of some of these other cases, but it's certainly fascinating and a great teaching opportunity. And does expose a little bit of the inner workings of the league, which the last thing the league wants is to have this type of dispute.
Yeah, I'd hate, you know, it'd be interesting being a fly on the wall at the owners' meetings as this thing works its way through.
All right, Jeremy, your final pick.
All right, my final pick. This is number eight, right? Number eight overall.
Yep. Yeah.
All right, number eight. I'm going to stay in pro sports. It is fascinating that our top six picks were collegiate athletics. Think about that. That's really interesting. So I'm going to pro sports, and I'm going to go and it's litigation that's still in the courts and in arbitration, not as recent as it could be, but I think the implications are substantial. I'm going with the Brian Flores lawsuit against the National Football League, as well as the Jim Trotter lawsuit, and they're related in the ways I'll describe, which is, so Brian Flores sued the league and all of its clubs for racial discrimination after his, I think what would generally be viewed as successful tenure with the Dolphins. He was fired, couldn't get another head coaching job. He sued. Part of the case is an arbitration pursuant to mandatory arbitration clause in the contracts he had. But with respect to, for example, the Giants, who he names, he never had a contract with them, didn't work for them. And so that's still in the federal court, along with the, he has allegations into the Broncos as well. What I think is most notable about this case, guys, is what it said. And what it's, and the I'm talking about the complaint, the bringing of the case, what the fact of the bringing of the case said. And what it said is that a person who claims race discrimination may not end their career by suing about it. So after he sued, a month later, he got hired as an assistant for the Steelers. He's now a defensive coordinator for the Vikings while he's suing the Vikings and the rest of the league. And some people thought that the him being hired would result in him dropping the suit. He's not dropped the suit. He's still suing. And so now Jim Trotter sued the National Football League. He argues he works for NFL. He's a writer for NFL Network. And he alleged that he challenged the commissioner at a press conference on issues of race and was fired as a matter of retaliation. And I don't know if, and now Jim's, I think, with The Athletic, unless I'm mistaken. But I don't know if Jim brings that suit if he doesn't see that Flores brought the suit and that Flores' career continues. And so what that might mean for people who feel as though they've been discriminated against based on race, gender, or any other characteristic, I think it's substantial. I think it means you can challenge allegedly discriminatory activity and still hope to remain a professional in sports. So that's why I take it at eight.
And I just, great picks. And I would just say, to me, it also brings up the larger issue of the role of arbitration. Yeah. This, I would say, excessive use of arbitration in the workplace, where, especially in the Flores matter, you have Goodell is the arbitrator of allegations against him. But literally, how, I get that's the law. Like, I'm not contesting, I understand why the judge wrote, but it just doesn't sound right to me. And I think it brings up all sorts of questions about equity, about fairness, fundamental fairness. And it sports sometimes brings to light things that we don't notice, even though they're occurring. And I feel like both of those cases do that.
Yeah, it's a great point. And it's a great pick. And I'm jealous of that pick that I didn't make that pick earlier, because I do. I think for both the issues you guys raised, and we've talked a lot about the arbitration issue in the player discipline cases when it's in terms of collective bargaining agreement. But here, where there is no CBA and it's just a regular old employment contract, then we're dealing with just the more standard issues that the typical employee who's not protected by a union has to deal with, where their disputes are pushed into arbitration, where they might not get a fair shake, where there's no publicity about it. And we've seen in other areas where states are trying to pare back on NDAs and pare back on arbitration. So I think this does fit into that broader thing. And this may have, certainly, I think of the, I guess this is only the second pro case, but a massive impact, not only in sports, but even beyond that. So I think it's a great pick. And I think, Jeremy, you were on my podcast talking about the Flores case when it first got filed.
Sure,
so
was.
It all comes full circle. All right. My last pick and the last Mr. Irrelevant or case irrelevant. I was going to, there were three on my board. The Diamond Sports bankruptcy, and not so much the particular bankruptcy issues, although I think they are interesting, but more what it means for the future of sports broadcasting, and maybe more what it suggests in the bigger picture of the change in sports broadcasting that might be coming, what we've seen with teams taking their rights in-house and creating their own streaming platform or broadcasting it on local television, and the issues that lots of fans are having with Bally Sports right now. They did reach a settlement, and so there's at least a temporary settlement with I think all three leagues, or at least NBA and NHL and Major League Baseball. They'll continue carrying it until end of next year. So I think that's a huge issue to watch, but it's not my pick. The other one that's not my pick is all the issues around trans athlete participation in sports. I think it's one, it from a legislative perspective and a legal perspective, I think there's probably more action in that across the country than in any of these other areas, just because every state is, or most states are dealing with this. And then also what it says about the balance between fair competition on the fields and fairness off the field. And how do you handle those two when you think somebody might be getting a competitive advantage, but we also want to recognize their rights in general. And so there's the trans issues, and then the different but related, the DSD issues with Caster Semenya, and how these governing bodies seem to be shifting now to more restrictive rules than there were in place 2 or 3 years ago. And at least this perception that there's a crisis that trans athletes or DSD athletes are dominating sports. And that's a topic for another time. Feel free to jump in. But I just think there's so much going on there, both from a social perspective, a religious perspective, a legal perspective, political perspective. So do you guys want to jump in on either of those cases before I announce case irrelevant?
No, I'll just say that I think they're both worth. Next time we do this, I think we should probably have 4 rounds. I don't know if 2 rounds are enough.
Yeah. Well, we have a supplemental draft.
Totally agree.
So my last pick is the death of Adam Johnson, the hockey player, who was a former NHL player, was playing for the Nottingham Panthers in England's elite hockey league. And then his throat was cut in a collision with a player on the Sheffield Steelers. When what some people are calling a freak accident, other people are calling it intentional, not that he intended to kill him, but that he intended to lock him with his skate, do something that is not part of the culture of hockey, or certainly was against the rules of hockey. And there's some question about whether criminal charges will be brought against the other player, whether this might be a case of involuntary manslaughter. There's now, as you might expect, some people coming out and saying, look, this guy was one of the most penalized players in the league. He was a dirty player. Other people saying he lost his balance, and so his leg kicked up. There's a video of it. I would caution people that you might not want to watch the video because it's very graphic, but it does show the player. It looks like he's almost doing a karate kick where he ends up slashing this player in the throat, and tragically the player died. And I think, again, put aside whether you can bring a criminal case or civil case for what happens on the court or on the ice. I'm sure we all teach torts in sports, and they're fun cases to teach. This is not a fun case to teach because of the outcome. But I think more the impact it might have on player health and safety. And it always seems to take a crisis like this to change something. And for this, it might be just the protective gear around necks. But it also raises the issue of accessibility, and can every youth hockey league afford that? Can all families, can players afford that? Is the NHL going to adopt it? And just the inherent risks that are in these sports, and how we balance, once again, our enjoyment of the game and our desire to see players go out 100% and fight for every inch versus protecting them, and not only protecting the pro athletes, but also college, high school, youth athlete. So again, may not be this case itself, but I think the conversation that it's starting to spur around player health and safety. So that's my final pick.
The great bet. We just talked about that matter in sports law yesterday in my class, and I have several former hockey players, and they all thought it was intentional, not to try to kill the person, Adam Johnson, but the act itself of sticking up the skate. The player at that level wouldn't lose his balance. It would be very unusual for that to happen unless there was some intent. And as you said, who knows if there'll be any criminal charges, but it's suspicious at a minimum, and it does raise the issue of whether the equipment is sufficiently safe whether the players are trained to not do things like that. It's a true tragedy, and maybe it was a crime. We'll find out.
Yeah, no, that's a very sobering note to end our draft on, because it is a true tragedy. And I think the questions gave of whether player health and safety and whether we're going to see evolution in equipment may well be tied to the possibility of a civil action being brought, criminal charges being brought, as those incentivize leagues and clubs to make moves. But I just remember when I was a little kid, I grew up in D.C. area. I was a big Washington Capitals fan. I remember half of the players, when I went to games as a little boy, didn't wear helmets at all. There were no helmets.
I remember that.
And then you started to see helmets, but nobody had a face mask, the glass shield at all. Then you started to see those. Goalies also did not have the neck throat protector. You see those now. And so I think when you have tragedies like this, it's necessary for sport to contemplate what is missing. Where are the gaps? And I think we're going to see evolution in protective gear in hockey as a consequence of this.
So do you guys remember, so to try to shift it to a slightly brighter note, the last NHL player to not wear a helmet in an NHL game? And do you remember what year it was?
Was it Rod Langway?
It was not Rob Langway. What year do you think it was?
87.
I'll say 89.
I would have thought 82, but it was 96, 97.
Ooh.
Which is shocking to me. Craig McTavish. Yeah.
Wow. He was grandfathered out. I thought they did that in 79, that rule. So he was
playing. I thought they did. Yeah, I thought Guy Lafleur. That was the one who I just had to Google it while we were talking. But yeah, at least according to this.
Wow.
It's Craig McTavish. And yeah, that's confirmed by the Hockey News, which is just hard to believe. That because I remember, I thought it was Guy Lafleur, like the only one skating around without a helmet, which just seemed, I get it. You're a traditionalist, but at a certain point, don't you say that this might be exceptionally unsafe that I'm the only one out here? All right. Two last quick ones to wrap up with. And if you guys have any other issues that almost got drafted that maybe you're going to pick up as undrafted free agents, but the two quickly, the minor league baseball antitrust suit, that was essentially challenging Major League Baseball's antitrust exemption that Jim Quinn, one of the most well-known and respected sports lawyers ever, he said on my podcast, he said many times that he brought that case to challenge the exemption, that he wanted to get to the Supreme Court as fast as possible. And so he was basically tanking the earlier cases so he could get to the Supreme Court. But then they settled. And I was shocked. I thought there was no way this case was going to settle because this was not about getting damages. This was just really about trying to overturn the exemption. The terms of the settlement are private, but I really thought we were going to have a chance to get the Supreme Court to rule on a baseball case, and that it certainly seemed like this Supreme Court would have been inclined to overrule the exemption. So I was disappointed and surprised by that case. And then the other one, and this is going straight into Mike's wheelhouse, is I do think it's only a matter of time before either the NBA or the NFL age restrictions are challenged again in court. I thought we were going to get, I think most people thought the NBA was going to eliminate the age restriction in their new CBA. Condoleezza Rice called for it in the Rice report that was commissioned by the NCAA about basketball. It just feels like with all the pressure at the college level, that if they're going to be these massive changes, and the sort of the educational piece maybe gets removed somewhat or de-emphasized, and the difference between pro and college gets erased a little bit, there are going to be more questions about, well, why can't I go straight to the NFL? Why can't I go to the league that's paying more than is paying in college? So those are my two other, the one is what not to watch because it's settled. And the other one is maybe what to watch with the age restrictions.
Yeah, I think your point about college football morphing into the pros, why wouldn't the NFL just allow the players to enter earlier? We know that if a case like that is brought in the Second Circuit, it wouldn't go anywhere, but there are other circuits where it might. And I don't know if there's a desire on the part of an athlete to go through what Maurice Claret went through. And I think if it's going to happen, it should be a group of them, not one player. But I think the case law in other federal circuits may be more favorable than certainly the Second Circuit. It's a non-starter. You never know.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think on the first of those two issues you raised, Gabe, it is interesting. I would love to, maybe in a situation, ultimately, Quinn is representing a client. Maybe the client was like, hey, I understand that you wanted this to be an impact case, but at the end of the day, there's a business matter for it. I don't know. Yeah. That's hard to say. So that's a possibility. The one free agent I'll pick up is Northwestern football. And both the lawsuits against the university and the former head coach with respect to the hazing and racism allegations with respect to hazing that allegedly happened on the football team. And then the former head coach's lawsuit against the university, he claims was wrongfully terminated and he's seeking $130 million. And so the university is defending lawsuits on both flanks there.
Okay. That wraps up the inaugural sports law issue draft. We'll figure out the scoring system in some future episode and also talk about the waiver wire and free agent pickups and trades. But thanks to Mike and Jeremy for participating. And thanks, as always, for listening. And thanks to our loyal sponsor, the Tulane Center for Sport. See you next time on SportsWise.